If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/wondery. rocketmoney.com/wondery.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Bill Cosby has been found guilty on all counts and now faces 10 years in prison for each of his three crimes. Oh, man, please tell me his lawyer is Michael Cohen.
From 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, please enjoy this podcast edition of Late Night with Seth Meyers. On today's show, Seth talks to comedian Patton Oswalt, one of the stars of the NBC sitcom AP Bio. Patton also sticks around to answer a few more questions exclusively for this podcast. But first, let's hear Seth take a closer look at the news.
President Trump went on Fox and Friends today and freaked out about the various criminal investigations around him during a rambling interview. For more on it, it's time for a closer look. It's genuinely disorienting how many crazy things are happening right now. I mean, just yesterday, Trump, President Trump, tweeted a thank you to Kanye West after Kanye tweeted that he and Trump are both Dragon Energy. Dragon Energy? Isn't that one of those shady boner pills they sell at convenience stores? Which, by the way, don't work, is something I've heard. And I'm sorry, but Donald Trump does not have Dragon Energy. Unless you mean dragging his fat ass around the golf course energy. This morning, President Dragon got his day started by calling into Fox and Friends. Trump rambled on for so long about so many random topics that at one point, the Fox and Friends hosts said they were the ones who were running out of time.
Nobody's been tougher to Russia than I am. You can ask President Putin about that. They break down doors for Paul Manafort early in the morning. His wife is in bed. I have known Kanye a little bit. Shania, who I think is terrific, I would give myself an A+. Okay. Even the enemies and the haters admit that. We have accomplished more than any president. I watched Leakin' Lion Comey last night. People say, you're still looking good, Mr. President. How do you do it? CNN, fake news CNN, actually gave the questions.
Yeah, but don't worry about them.
I want to ask you.
But think of it. How bad is that? So Comey leaked. When I came into office, people thought we were going into nuclear war, okay? And now they're saying, looks like that's going to be taken care of.
Mr. President.
I think we're doing very well. Let's see what happens.
Okay, we're running out of time.
Wow. That was the first time in history that a TV show had to change its phone number because of a stalker. Now, the big news out of this interview had to do with Trump's personal attorney, Michael Cohen, whose office and home were raided by the FBI in their investigation of the Stormy Daniels hush payment. Up to this point, Trump has insisted that he had nothing to do with that hush payment that Cohen made to Daniels, as he did during a Q&A with reporters on Air Force One.
Mr. President, did you know about the $130,000 payment to Stormy Daniels? Then why did Michael Cohen make it if there was no
truth around
payment?
Well, you have to ask Michael Cohen. Michael's my attorney, and you'll have to ask Michael.
So that was Trump's public position until today, when he did a total 180 during a truly crazy rant where he was all over the place on Cohen. First, Trump defended Cohen while claiming he didn't know anything about his business.
Michael is in business. He's really a businessman, a fairly big business, as I understand it. I don't know his business. But this doesn't have to do with me. Michael is a businessman. He's got a business. He also practices law. I would say probably the big thing is his business. And they're looking at something having to do with his business. I have nothing to do with his business. I can tell you, he's a good guy.
But isn't your isn't his business your attorney, Mr. President?
Well, I have many, many, just so you understand, I have many attorneys. I have attorneys, sadly, I have so many attorneys you wouldn't even believe it.
You have so many attorneys and not one of them told you to keep your mouth shut? Which one of them told you it was a good idea to call a TV show on 3 hours sleep? I just love how you know when Trump's having a breakdown because he can't stop saying business.
North Korea, business.
But here in the interview was the kicker.
Michael would represent me and represent me on some things. He represents me, like, with this crazy Stormy Daniels deal.
Okay. So at first he said he had nothing to do with the Stormy Daniels case. Now he says Cohen represented him in the Stormy Daniels case. Can you imagine Trump in court? The prosecution wouldn't even need to be there. He can just cross-examine himself.
I don't know Michael Cohen. Objection, Your Honor. I do know Michael Cohen. Objection sustained. Take me away. Hey, you're being rough. Hey, relax, buddy.
But the biggest and most problematic part of Trump's answer came when he was asked how much of his legal work was handled by Cohen. Now, remember, both Cohen and Trump's lawyers are arguing in court that the documents the FBI seized in their raid are covered under attorney-client privilege, meaning the feds would not be able to look at them. So if you're Trump, you're supposed to be arguing that Cohen is your lawyer. And that because he handled most of your legal work, those documents are protected and cannot be looked at by the feds. That's all you have to say. If you're ever asked, he is your most important lawyer.
Mr. President, how much of your legal work was handled by Michael Cohen?
Well, as a percentage of my overall legal work, a tiny, tiny little fraction.
That's probably the same answer he gives when his lawyers ask him if he's paying attention. Donald, do not talk about this case on TV. Do you understand?
I do, but only a tiny, tiny little fraction. Kanye tweeted about me.
And sure enough, immediately after Trump contradicted his own lawyers, prosecutors used Trump's comments in a court filing less than 2 hours later, writing in their brief, President Trump reportedly said on cable television this morning that Cohen performs a tiny, tiny fraction of his legal work. Man, you picture prosecutors digging for evidence. Now all they need is remote control. I bet this morning one of them said, hey, should I print out the brief? And another one said, oh, let's hold off. He's on TV. I bet he's going to say something. Yet somehow that wasn't the stupidest thing Donald Trump said this morning. Because if you'd been publicly accused of paying hush money to cover up multiple affairs, the very least you could do for your wife would be to get her a gift on her birthday. And yet, after going out of his way to bring up the fact that today is Melania's birthday, Trump admitted he hadn't got her anything.
Thank you so much for being with us, Mr. President.
Well, good morning, and I picked a very, very special day because it's Melania's birthday. So I said, let's do it on Melania's birthday. So happy birthday to Melania.
All right. Hopefully there'll be visits in between, but have you decided on, or do you want to tell us what you got her?
Well, I better not get into that because I may get in trouble. Maybe I didn't get her so much. I'll tell you what, she has done. I got her a beautiful card. You know, I'm very busy to be running out looking for presents, okay? But I got a beautiful card. There's some beautiful flowers.
All right, let me say this. If you raided the White House right now, you might not find evidence of collusion with Russia, but you would definitely not find a card or flowers. Because if that's what you got, you lead with that. You don't go, oh, it is her birthday, so, you know, there's, a card. I got her a card. The timing of Trump's Fox & Friends interview really could not have been worse for him because this week there have been major developments in the Cohen investigation. For example, yesterday it was reported that Cohen told a judge he will invoke his Fifth Amendment right not to incriminate himself in the Stormy Daniels case. Now, obviously, pleading the Fifth does not mean you are guilty. It is a constitutional right and an important one. But I bet I know someone who disagrees.
Here's people taking the Fifth Amendment. Like you see on the mob, right? You see the mob takes the Fifth. If you're innocent, why are you taking the Fifth Amendment?
When you have your staff taking the Fifth Amendment, I think it's disgraceful. She lies to Congress under oath, and her ringleaders took the Fifth Amendment. In so many ways, it's worse than Watergate.
The guy who set up the server, remember him?
and he pleaded the Fifth. He pleaded the Fifth Amendment. Wait, what are we going to do with this guy? This is like a third world country, folks.
Oh, come on. If this were a third world country, we'd have some insane dictator installing his family in government positions and giving himself military parades. And all right, you might have something there. And Cohen's invocation of the Fifth Amendment comes just a day after Trump was asked during a meeting with French President Emmanuel Macron whether he might pardon Cohen, and he dismissed the question out of hand.
Mr. President, what about Michael Cohen? Are you considering...
Thank you very much. Stupid question.
Look at Macron's face. He's like the third wheel at dinner with a couple who can't stop fighting. Like, do you guys want me to go? I mean, zoot the lore, you guys. But it's not a stupid question. The question of whether Trump might pardon Cohen is a significant one because it might determine whether Cohen flips and cooperates with prosecutors in return for a more lenient sentence. But should Trump really be worried Cohen would flip on him? I'm sure if Cohen was loyal to Trump, Trump always respected Cohen, right? Well, according to the Wall Street Journal, Trump didn't always demonstrate respect for his employee. After saying he'd attend Cohen's son's bar mitzvah in 2012, Trump was late and the blessings were delayed. After Trump arrived, he gave a speech telling guests he hadn't planned to come, but he relented after Cohen had repeatedly called him, his secretary, and his children begging him to appear. The guests laughed because everyone knew it was very realistic sounding. So the whole thing worked as a reverse bar mitzvah for Cohen. He went in a man and came out a boy. Also, mazel tov, Robert Mueller, because Cohen is definitely gonna flip. So the president is dealing with multiple criminal probes and keeps changing his story. At this point, anyone who's asking whether Trump is telling the truth is asking a
stupid question.
This has been a closer look. Our guest is a Grammy and Emmy Award-winning comedian you know from his work in The Goldbergs, The King of Queens, and the hit film Ratatouille. He stars as Principal Durbin in the comedy AP Bio, which airs Thursday nights at 8:30 here on NBC. Please welcome back to the show our very good friend Patton Oswalt, everyone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I want to talk about AP Bio. That was why you were here today.
Yes.
But sometimes events conspire, and we have something else to talk about.
Yes. I've been awake since 3 a.m.
Yeah.
So I don't know how this segment's going to go. But my late wife, Michelle McNamara, as you know, was a true crime writer, true crime journalist, investigative reporter, and she, when she passed away, she was nearly done, three-fourths done, with a book.
Yep, got it right here.
Called I'll Be Gone in the Dark, about California's worst uncaught serial killer, who she dubbed the Golden State Killer. He was responsible for 12 murders, 50 rapes over like a decade, had gone uncaught for 42 years. She did all this research. And this morning, I start getting texts and alerts. They arrested him today. He is in jail. And the guy is named, J.J. D'Angelo. He was a former policeman from Auburn, right near the Sacramento area where the rapes first started. So now there's all this, you know, her book and the article that led to the book really amped up all the interest in the case and really put a lot of focus on this. Not to discredit the work that the police and the lab technicians did, but it is this, it was her dream. She didn't care about, she always said, I don't care about credit. I want to know that he's in jail. And now he's caught. The bracelets are on, and it feels like this thing that she wanted so badly is now done. Like, it just feels amazing.
It's such a... she's an incredible writer and has an incredible way with language. And so in ways, even though it's about this really obviously dark subject, it's a beautifully written book. And a lot of people I saw on social media today were sort of... you know, tweeting out this last bit that she wrote, which seems really fitting.
Oh, yeah,
would you want to, would you mind reading it? Is that?
Yes.
Here, let me give that to you.
Yeah, her afterword in the book is called Letter to an Old Man, which she writes this to the Golden State Killer, and these are the final lines of it. this is her writing. One day soon, you'll hear a car pull up to your curb, an engine cut out. You'll hear footsteps coming up your front walk, like they did for Edward Wayne Edwards, 29 years after he killed Timothy Hack and Kelly Drew in Sullivan, Wisconsin, like they did for Kenneth Lee Hicks, 30 years after he killed Laura Billingsley in Aloha, Oregon. The doorbell rings. No side gates are left open. You're long past leaping over a fence. Take one of your hyper-gulping breaths. Clench your teeth. Inch timidly toward the insistent bell. This is how it ends for you. You'll be silent forever, and I'll be gone in the dark, you threatened a victim once. Open the door, show us your face, walk into the light. And that's what he did today. So it's like this.
That's really something. And it's also, you know, obviously she did all this incredible work. It's really also incredible that you and the other people you mentioned, you completed this work for
her. I mean, I begged them to help. Billy Jensen and Paul Haynes were the ones who stepped up. I was still, you know, neck deep in grief and suddenly a single father and not sleeping. But I was like, I can't. I knew that I wouldn't be able to live and go on with life if this was left undone. So I basically begged them and the publishers find a way to, and they were the ones who found a way to finish it and put it together. And now, you know, they, there's all, because he's been caught, now they can start linking him to all these other cases. There's all this new evidence. I mean, it's amazing. I mean, he's a former cop.
Yeah.
And, you know, at one point he quit. And this sounds like something out of John Mulaney's bit about Law and Order. I remember that classic bit about how here's what happened. He quit the police force when he was caught shoplifting a hammer and dog repellent. And he would break into houses. And literally, like, you're shoplifting a hammer. Are you shopping at the murder store? Like, what? Yeah. It could not be more. So, those kind of clues. And then he just kind of, but that was in the 70s. And they went, well, if he wants to quit, he quits. And they didn't follow up. Like, it was all this. Again, he just got caught today. This is the beginning of this whole other chapter of this saga, this insane crime saga. So I'm on adrenaline and sleeplessness right now about this.
Makes sense. I would say it's impossible to transition, so let me just show a picture of you in high school.
Oh,
there you go.
Oh, God.
That's, I think, the best we can do. Police are still looking for him.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So you...
I'm going to marry a crime fighter one day.
So you, I only bring this up because you were playing Principal Durbin in AP Bio.
Yes.
Did you base it on any of your principles in your time?
I based my character on it because basically I play a character, and this is the best thing to play comedically. I play an authority figure with zero authority.
Yeah.
I know that I cannot make anything happen and no one will listen to me. So I base it on this vice principal that I had in high school, who was a really cool guy, but he had so kind of beautifully accepted that I have no authority and the kids don't care. And then also, if you remember the movie Mean Girls?
Sure.
Remember Tim Meadows
played
the principal? One of the funniest, because he is so, he's almost at this level of zen of like, I have no power. I can affect no change. But it's so hilarious how comfortable he is.
Well, it is, you're a perfect fit. It's a wonderful show. And, thanks for spending this crazy day with us. It's always just such a delight to see you.
I could have begged it off and say I haven't slept, but no, I wanted to come and share that it's really good news. I'm frazzled, but it's great news. So,
Patton Oswalt, everybody. AP Bio airs Thursday nights at 8:30 here on NBC.
Hey, this is Kevin from Late Night. We are backstage with Patton Oswalt.
I was literally sitting here like I was on camera. Like I was looking for the red light. My God. Sorry. Okay, go ahead.
That's all right. it's been a crazy day. You talked about it with Seth, but just sort of this whirlwind of, you were in Chicago this morning.
I woke up this morning, started getting pings at, I think, 3:30 a.m. I don't even remember. And that there had been an arrest of this guy, Joseph Delgado. And he, this was a book that my wife had worked on for years, and you know, a case that she'd been obsessed with for 10. And so then just to kind of keep up with all the updates and, oh my God, what's going on? And so
she'd always sort of had a fascination with serial killers.
It's weird. It's not that she had a fascination with serial killers. She had a fascination with the mechanics of how they are caught. I mean, obviously, yeah, she had a fascination with their MO, what they did, but it was always towards, now, how do we reverse engineer a portrait of this person and figure out who he or she is so that they can be caught? And then she was just as fascinated with the lives of the investigators and how that affected their lives, and then the lives of the survivors and the victims' families, and how, you know, one person with bad wiring can really leave a swath of destruction. Mm-hmm. And that is what, you know, it just worked on so many multi-literary levels, the way she could do that.
When she was writing the book, how involved were you? How close to it were you? Would she share a lot of the progress that she was making in terms of the suspects?
Yeah, she would read me chapter. She wasn't so much concerned with the progress in the case at first. What she was more focused on was, am I telling the story in a way that will hook people so that they will stay with this? Because it's a very lengthy, it took place over decades and different neighborhoods. So can I keep people's focus on this? Mm-hmm. That was her main thing. So she would read chapters more that way.
Yeah.
Like, okay, do you follow this whole story here? Because these are little slices of time. California, you know, Sacramento in the 70s, Southern California in the 80s, like all that stuff.
It was like a 10-year period, right?
He was in Sacramento, then he vanished, then he shows up in Santa Barbara, then he shows up in Irvine. It was just this, you know, this a monster in a hurry. It was a combination of really good DNA sleuthing by the police and district attorneys, and then her restoking interest in the case with the magazine articles and the blog entries. And, you know, she first wrote about him in 2010. Mm-hmm. And it was weird how at the police press conference today, they dismissed her book as like, it didn't really help. But then all the timelines are like, suddenly there's this weird spike in interest in 2010. Yes, because of what it's... And then they also kept saying Golden State Killer, which is, that's the name she gave him. So, and that was the name that kind of helped him pop more that way. So it was a little frustrating watching that, but I understand why they were doing what they were doing. I wish they'd been a little more gracious about it.
And HBO optioned the rights for this to become a documentary series.
Yesterday was the first day of filming in Chicago, and then we wake up like, what the... And now the director's like, well, it changes the movie, but it doesn't stop the movie. Now it's just a different movie. We're going to do... Now we can research him and do his life and do Michelle's as a parallel. Wow. Like, where are they going to meet? So... I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen right now. It's wonderfully up in the air. Yeah.
Thank you so much for being here today and coming on despite having such a... Well, like you said, it's good news. It's an exciting day.
It is good news. Yeah, but good God. Yeah.
Crazy. And check out AP Bio.
Oh, yeah. By the way, I'm on a comedy called AP Bio. It's really fun.
Yeah. Great. Patton, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hi, everyone. It's Sarah from Late Night. I'm here with Jeremiah Silva, who is a talent executive on our show and who is also responsible for booking our musical guests. One of the guests he booked is Lily Allen, who is with us as well.
Hi. Hi, everyone.
We're very excited because typically we do these backstage interviews with guests on the show. We don't always get to talk to artists who perform. So we're very happy that you are here and you are joining us. So thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
Well, let me just say that I have feel like I've been chasing you to get you here since our show started, so I'm really happy that you're here.
I'm happy to be here.
Right. I'm a huge fan. I'm really excited for the new record, and so thanks for spending some extra time with us.
Yes, thanks for being here.
Pleasure.
So the new album is called No Shame. It's out on June 8th. Mm-hmm. First of all, it's great. Congratulations. I wanted to say, from listening to it, it did remind me a lot of your first two albums. Mm-hmm. Maybe... It's Not Me, It's You more. Mm-hmm. But then I read that that was maybe intentional, that you kind of went back to make this record the way you had made the
stuff
first
before.
Two.
Kind of. I mean, I think I've always had like the same approach to writing music, except for on the third album. And that wasn't really intentional. That was just because I was having a midlife crisis, age 27. But yeah, I think I was like, I had a very clear idea and focus on the first two records, as I did with this one. But on the third record that I did, I just felt like I was, I don't know, I just had babies. I was like just not really feeling myself. And I think I listened to people more than I ordinarily would have done, if that makes any sense.
That makes a lot of sense.
So like, I don't think I was like, I wasn't manipulated or like pushed into doing anything. I just think I didn't have that conviction in myself. So I wasn't, you know, I wasn't quite sure, and I didn't have the confidence to like, you know, put my money where my mouth was. So I was sort of like shopping out for like opinions, you know, like, should I do this? Do you like the sound of this song? What should I wear? Should I wear, you know, and it all started to get a bit messy. And then, you know, this album feels like a little bit of a return to the approach of the first two, because I really was like, okay, what is this job?
Right.
What is it that I want to do? I think also with the third record, you know, there were people that had sort of expectations, like the record company or, you know, management, that, you know, I should sit in the charts where I used to and be on front cover of magazines, etc. And so kind of that became the goal rather than making really good music. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I just kind of got a little bit lost in all of that. But this, yeah, this time around, it was like, okay, what do you want to do? I just want to make really good music. Do you want to be a famous pop star? Well, that would be really great if people really liked the music, and that came after.
Right,
perfect.
Like icing on the cake.
Yeah, but that's not the primary goal. The primary goal is to make something that I really enjoy, that I think the fans will respect, and that they can hear that, you know, I'm enjoying it, and also something that I can take on the road, because, you know, going out on the road is incredibly repetitive. You know, it can be really lonely and isolating, and if you're not enjoying what you're doing on stage, mm-hmm. that's when you run into real difficulties. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened with me last time. So
I think that's interesting, because as a fan, because I'm such a music fan, I go along with the artist on their journey from mm-hmm. album to album, never thinking about that stuff. Mm-hmm. So when I listened to Sheezus, I loved it, like absorbed it, like mm-hmm. listened to everything, and never would have thought anything, except for that's kind of where you were in your life when you were making the record. But saying that, when I listen to it now, I kind of see it in a different way. I also think a lot of that album was really ahead of its time. So like, especially like Heart Out Here, mm-hmm. like that song right now is so it makes so much sense now in the world that we live in. Mm-hmm. And I can't imagine like that when you were making it.
No, and actually, I mean, not to blow my own trumpet, but I think I've always been like a little bit ahead of my time, like with the MySpace stuff. And, you know, so much as music is to do with social media now. And honestly, like the last 5-10 years, I've been begging my record company to like give me money to be able to like shoot, you know, behind the scenes stuff and content for my mm-hmm. Instagram. And they're just like, are you mad? Why would we do that? Cut to now. That's literally everybody's all anybody doing is doing. And it was the same thing with MySpace. You know, I wanted to give away my music for free. And I was like, listen, trust me, people will tell you what they like. And then you'll know where to spend your, you know, right. what songs to make a right. video for. Like, it, don't be scared of people listening to stuff first. And they're like, no, you're crazy.
That's
cut
so
to now.
No, and that's, everything
that's exactly what everyone right. does. And also, you know, with songs like The Fear, that couldn't be more relevant now.
I agree.
FU couldn't be more relevant now, totally. Even though it's a different president. So yeah, I'm basically Nostradamus. So
that's great. I actually think a lot of the songs on No Shame could be part two-ishes to mm-hmm. some previous songs, like The Fear, where you talk about consumption and all yeah. of that stuff. A lot of the songs on the album now, at least in the beginning of the album, where it feels yeah. more of like that Lily that we know. Mm-hmm. And then I think the album progresses into a more like positive, always keeping like how cheeky you are, which I think is what the fans love about you, yeah. is your turn of phrase and the way that you have an interesting way of looking at the world and all of that stuff, and the way that you write to reflect that, which I think is super cool.
Mm. Thank you. You said that you got a lot of pushback from your record label mm-hmm. for the third album. And I read an interview, I think it was with NME that you did, about this is sort of an album where there was less meddling with
yeah,
the label.
I mean, I hired a new manager. It's a friend of mine, been a friend of mine for many years, called Seb. In fact, he was my boyfriend many years ago. And he was an A&R man for a major record label for many years. He doesn't do that anymore. He also manages Francis and the Lights. And I just sort of was like, listen, I just want you to be my point of contact. I don't really want to speak to anyone from the record label. Not because I don't like them, but just because I was so wary of like not wanting to take other people's opinions on board, right. and for me to have one person that I had a kind of direct line with.
So you could
with.
Just be creative.
Exactly. And, you know, and I just kind of kept writing until Seb and me were just like, I think it's done. You know?
So that, do you think that comes with experience of having the breadth of music that you've done, or age, or a combination of things?
I guess so. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm only as old as I am today, you know, so right. I can't really tell you whether it's to do with experience or not, but
it's also probably part of making the third album and not wanting to do that again.
Definitely the third album was great experience. Well, it was a terrible experience, but it was also a great experience in a lesson in like what I definitely don't ever want to do again. I don't hate the songs. Like, I actually quite like, you know, I like them. I wouldn't have put them on a record if I didn't, but it was everything around it. And, you know, and music's so visual for me. So when I listen to the music, I just catapulted back to that time, and it makes me sad. So, yeah.
The fans love it.
Okay, well, let's change the subject then.
The fans love it.
They do. Especially, like, Silver Spoon, I think it's... I found Silver Spoon the way that I found Friday Night on the first album.
Okay.
Like, by accident. Like, it was playing, and I was like, what is this song? And then I had to go back and learn all the words to Silver Spoon. It's just so clever and cheeky, and I think, like, you were, like, speaking back to people that were saying things about you in such a funny way. Anyways, all right, so let's talk about the new album. First, I wanted to talk about Trigger Bang. That's the lead single from the album, or would you say?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, this is the other thing, is that there aren't really, like, any, like, singles on it. It's like, I mean, there are, because record companies like to release music in that way, but I kind of wanted to just drop everything at
together.
Once. And, you know, I lost that battle. But, yeah, I guess it was the first song that we serviced to radio. Although, actually, it was a leak. It was a mistake. It wasn't meant to be released.
Well, what I think is so interesting about it is everybody, I would think, could relate to that experience, right? Of like when you're younger and you're doing whatever you want, making bad choices, blah, blah. Then there comes a time where you know that's not good for you, or you don't want to be that person anymore, whatever. But there's always triggers that bring you back. Like everybody has that friend that brings them back to that place where you're like, oh, I shouldn't be doing this anymore. And it's so, I thought it was such a clever song to talk about that, and about how I can't do this anymore, I can't hang with these cool kids because they bring me back to that place, I can't be that person anymore.
It's a bit of that. I mean, also, I don't know, you guys probably don't know because it wasn't like big news over here, but I had a stalker in the UK for like 7 years who ended up breaking into my house, and I had to, you know, move out of my house. It was a big court case, and it was, you know, really, it was scary. And you know, while my kids were there and stuff, I mean, it was really terrifying. Anyway, and, you know, he wanted to kill me. Like, that's why he was there. It was really, really scary. But after that, I, you know, it affected me quite deeply psychologically. And I was very isolated and disconnected from all of my friends, all, you know, my family. I just didn't, I completely just, like, went into myself. And that's, you know, it, although it is, you know, I'm not in recovery, but, you know, I don't party like I used to. But yeah, after this sort of like period of time where I was so isolated from people, when I was trying to kind of like re-enter like social scene in London, it was really hard because it was, I didn't really want to talk about this thing, but everything else just seemed so shallow and hollow in comparison to what it was that I'd experienced. And you know, when people say, you know, how are you, you want to say, I'm really not very good, somebody tried to kill me, but it's
nobody
a bit
wants to hear that.
it's a bit intense, you know, for the pub or whatever.
How much time do you have?
So that's kind of what it was. It was almost like, you know, just being out in like normality was a trigger for me, because I'd experienced this like really intense traumatic thing. So it was about the partying as well, but it was also just about, yeah, it was just a weird time.
It's so interesting because it shows you that everybody can take something from a song differently.
Well, that's exactly, I always have that when I'm writing. I'm always like, I kind of have a checklist of things, and it's sort of like, you know, does this mean something to me? Yes. Is it valuable information to other people? You know, sometimes it's too personal. It can't be applied to somebody else. And, you know, and will other people be able to relate to it? And so, yeah, sometimes I'll be a little bit too descriptive about one or two things, and I'll have to pull it back because people won't be able to project them, you know, see themselves in the narrative.
Too specific.
Yeah.
Tonight on the show, you're going to perform Three, which I don't know if this is true. You can say, was the first song you wrote from somebody else's point of view?
Yeah, true.
And do you want? Can you talk a little bit about whose point of view?
It is a song written from the perspective of both my daughters, although it sounds like it's just from one person's perspective, but, well, it is really, but I just don't want to have to tell them which one. So it's both. But yeah, it's about, you know, them being confused about their mum having to leave the whole time, you know, and it's, you know, written from the perspective of a three-year-old child.
Was that a hard thing to do after, I mean, I'm sure it was, but like when you have little children, but you're still on the road, like, and they can't always come with you. Like, it must be so hard to leave them.
Yeah, I think what's,
is that what inspired
it's really hard, like, on a selfish level, just because I love spending time with them. But also, it's just difficult to, like, articulate it, you know? Like, right. When you're three and your mom's going, I love you, I love you, I love you so much. Like, smothering, you know, them almost mm-hmm. with love. And then 5 minutes later, like, goodbye.
Yeah.
Right. That's like really weird thing for a child to compute. It's like, but you just said you loved me. And I think that, you know,
did they say that to you?
No, they didn't. But, you know, I internalized a lot of stuff as a kid. So I just assume that my kids will be doing the same thing. Too. But, you know, I just think I have to be really careful with like how much I tell them I love them because I'm not there the whole time. And I think when you're that young, if somebody's, you know, showering you with stuff and then 10 minutes later they're gone, you must think, what have I done wrong? Because
where are you?
Well, where, what else would you think?
When they're a little older, you can put them in the band.
Yeah. Well, they don't have a concert. They don't understand like what money is or what, like why you have to go.
Why you have to leave. Yeah. But I think that probably makes for a great parent that you're able to have that perspective to help them and see it from that point of view, because I don't think a lot of people even think about that.
Right. A lot of people are oblivious that they're even... That they
I
may
think
feel,
that's a very but, sensitive perspective to have in a good way.
Good mom.
Yeah.
And then I was going to talk about Family Man, which you worked on with Mark Ronson, who you worked with before. We love Mark Ronson. What I love about that song is it kind of flips the roles. Like can you talk a little bit about that song? And
yeah, well, I mean, it's you know, on the last record, when I was touring, I kind of was touring to excess, shall we say, and living the, you know, rock and roll lifestyle, but like the sort of stereotypical like male rock star lifestyle, you know, the like what happens on tour stays on tour, like, yeah, anyway, that was me, and it was great and it was fun, but not really. I don't know, maybe men feel like better about like returning home and keeping a lid on that stuff. I personally couldn't. I was like, I was just rid with guilt and shame, and yeah, and it was annoying to me because, you know, when I'm on tour with like 25 guys who are all married and all have kids and all do exactly the same thing, and they've got no problem behaving like that and going, not all of them, by the way, just in case any of their wives are listening. But yeah, I mean, it happens, you know, and I was interested in that dynamic of like, you know, why do I mean,
yeah,
it's just such an interesting play on words. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah.
I wanted to know, we have a great number of authors and novelists and sort of thinkers on our show as guests, and Seth is always interested in finding out who they read or who they listen to or who they're inspired by when they're not focused on their own project. Mm-hmm. So I wondered, when you're not performing or writing, are there certain artists that you find yourself coming back to or continuously inspired by, especially as of late, in the last, like when you were maybe working on this or what you listen to in your
not
leisure?
Not really. Especially when I'm writing, I'm really self-involved. Like, okay. I pretty much only listen to myself. And I write a lot, you know, in my diaries and stuff or my notebooks, and I just reread stuff to try and get, I mean, I really am, you know, and then I'm on my Twitter feed looking at my mentions, very self-obsessed person. But I mean, I guess, you know, I also like purposefully don't, I mean, I'll listen to the greats, so I'll listen to like Blossom Dearie and Ella Fitzgerald and, you know, like the Stone Roses or Happy Mondays, you know, whatever from the past. But I tend not really to want to listen to anything current because I just don't want to be led by it. I don't want to be like, this is what's working on the radio, so I've got to make music that sounds like this. So yeah. I try, and also because I'm like such a codependent person and I will copy people, you know, for success, that I can't, I know that I can't listen to it because it's like, I just can't help. I also don't have a lot of like self-confidence. So it's like, I never think anything that I do is good enough. So, you know, if I hear something that's current and really good, I'm just like, ugh.
Do you still feel like that now?
I'll just do that.
So when you still go do a show, like you're going to play at Music Hall of Williamsburg tonight, when those fans are singing your songs back to you, it still feels like in the beginning, like you can't believe it.
Yeah, I mean, I just think, I don't know, I just think like, what are you guys like? You don't know how much of an idiot I am.
That's amazing.
I always just think like, I can't believe like I managed to get, you know, 500 people like to buy tickets to come here. It's insane. Yeah, why?
Well, there will be a lot of people cheering for you tonight on the show when you perform, and we're really thrilled to have you here.
Yeah.
Hopefully you'll come back.
Yay.
Thanks, Ellie.
Thank you. Thanks.
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers? Be sure to follow the handle at Late Night Seth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. And please tell your friends who are fans of Seth Meyers to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.